blow-by-blow of Sammy's plan. Sammy Grubner. The name rings a bell, but... He shook his head. Can he do it? Can he take the house? I wish there was a way out. But Mags's lawyer has gone over it and checked with the mayor's office. Sammy has had his eye on the property for a long time, so once he convinced the mayor the time was right, he jumped on it. William sighed. All in the name of progress, I suppose. I nodded. So much life in that old house, he said. Sammy used to come around the hideaway every once in a while. He'd tell Mags he could set her up nicely for the rest of her days if she'd only sell. Every time, she'd practically chase him off the porch. I don't think Sammy ever understood what kind of woman Mags was. William chuckled. So she wasn't interested in passing her time with shuffleboard and Sudoku? Not quite. The only time I ever saw her sit down and relax was when she went to the garden at night to sit on your bench. Otherwise, she spent her time working on something. The boat motor, her vegetables, replacing a missing board on the dock. Sounds a lot like me, William said. Keeping busy, making things with my hands, is the only way I know how to live. It's the only way for me to keep Maggie with me. Well, that and the keys. The engravings, I said slowly. You made those. He nodded. It's my trademark. I've carved that key into everything I've made since I met her. But it's more than my mark. It's my inspiration. Or more accurately, she's my inspiration. She held the key to my heart back then, as well as now. As much as it meant to me, though, I didn't think she'd ever thought about it again. Seeing it carved into the marble on her headstone, well, I wasn't sure what to do with that. I guess that's why I finally made myself come back and ask some questions. I sure am glad I found you. I am too. We were both quiet a moment. Can I ask you a question? I asked. Of course. Why do you call her Maggie? He smiled. It seemed like she was making a fresh start in her life, so I gave her a new name to go with it. And you call her Mags? I nodded. I guess somewhere along the way it was shortened. He sat back in his chair and crossed his hands over his middle. So Sammy is taking the house. I looked out at the water, but kept an eye on William. Memory is a powerful thing, he said. My memories of Maggie have kept me going all these years, even though I hadn't seen the house, much less her, in decades. But the house isn't the keeper of memories for me. Mine are up here. He tapped his forehead. You're different, though. Losing the house will be a bigger blow for you, I imagine. A year ago, 6 months ago even, losing the house probably wouldn't have even registered on my radar. But now, everything about this new, unexpected chapter of my life was tied to the house in some way. Losing it felt like losing a part of my body I'd just learned how to use. After lunch, William drove me home. We made no immediate plans to see each other again, but I wasn't worried. We had a lifetime of absence to make up for. I hugged him before I left his car, and he patted my cheek. That night, long after Dot and the others had gone to bed, I walked through the house, dark except for a light in the kitchen. In the downstairs hallway, I paused in front of Mag's bedroom door. Dot and Glory had done a little cleaning out, taking bags of odds and ends to Goodwill and Sweet Bay United Methodist for their annual rummage sale. They told me they were leaving Mag's clothes and personal belongings for me to go through. I turned the knob and the door creaked open. I'd requested that Mag's room be the last one to undergo renovation, so everything looked as it always had. Single bed pushed up against one wall, a dresser along the opposite wall, chair and ottoman in one corner. Her vanity sat under the window that overlooked the backyard and the bay. I turned on a lamp and sat on the small stool in front of the mirror. A pot of Pond's cold cream sat on the top next to a tube of Jergens lotion, a couple prescription bottles, and an old silver-handled hairbrush. I twisted the top off the Pond's and inhaled. It was Mag's scent. Granted, the scent was usually mixed with something else, dirt, brackish water, motor oil, but the pond's was always underneath. The top drawer of the vanity held a variety of hairpins, travel-sized shampoo bottles, a box of needles, and small spools of thread. In the middle of all these trivial items, a pearl necklace gleamed in the lamplight. I smiled. Most people would have wrapped something like this in tissue and protected it in a jewelry box, but not Mags. She just dropped it in with everything else. The bottom drawer appeared to be empty, but when I pushed it closed, I heard something inside skid across the wood. I pulled the drawer back open and leaned down to peer in. Way at the back was an envelope. I reached in and pulled it out. My mother's name was written on the front. I turned the envelope over. It was still sealed, never opened. I moved my fingers over the envelope and felt a folded piece of paper inside. It wasn't for me, but it had been for my mom, and for some reason she'd never read it. Should I? I slid my finger under the flap and opened the letter. My dear Jenny, as I write this, you are a lovable 9-year-old running around the beach with salty air in your face. The thought of telling you what I'm about to share on paper is unfathomable. That's why I plan to give this to you when you're much older. Hopefully by then you'll be able to better understand the complexity of the human heart and how it can clutch both hope and pain in the same tight fist. Up until now, you've been told that your father, Robert, died of a heart attack years ago when you were a toddler. It is true that a man named Robert Van Buren died when you were 3 and of a heart attack, but this man was not your father. When I finished the letter, I ran my fingers across my mom's name on the front of the envelope. Then I wiped my cheeks and replaced the letter inside. It was late and I was tired, but instead of going upstairs, I lay down on Mag's bed. I slid the envelope under the pillow and closed my eyes. Chapter 42, Sarah, August. Despite the signs and pleas from Sweet Bay, Sammy and Mayor McLean did not relent. The mayor sent a firm but apologetic note explaining that we would be compensated for the value of the house, which none of us cared about. Sammy showed up on the doorstep 2 days later with a court order in his hands. You have 30 days to vacate the premises. You don't want to be here after that. He backed down the steps and walked to his car, but he stopped before he opened the door. Miss Jenkins, this doesn't have to be all that bad. You'll get on back to New Orleans and go about your business. I'll set things in motion here and move on to my next acquisition. He opened his car door and sat down. Life goes on. Later that evening, hours after Sammy had dropped off his court order like an unwanted fruitcake, the 5 of us sat in the living room together. "I'm proud of you," Dot said. "You turned this house into something magnificent, which is exactly what Mags wanted. You should be proud of yourself, too." "What are you going to do?" I held a mug of Lady Grey tea, but it had long grown cold. "We're moving down to Florida," she said. "We should have done it years ago. If you'd told me when I first moved in here that I'd outlive Mags and still be here at this age, I'd have told you to go jump in the bay. This place gave us a wonderful life, but everyone has to join the real world sometime." She paused and shook the ice cubes in the bottom of her glass. "I suppose our time has come, almost 50 years later." "Just like that?" I asked. "It's such a quick change." Dot looked at Bert and he nodded. "It's not so quick," she said. "We've talked about it on and off for years, but just never put the plan in motion. But it's time now, and we're okay with it. Don't worry about us." I thought I heard a wobble in her voice, but her face remained calm, almost cheerful. "What about you?" I searched Glory's face for any indication of panic or sadness. If I'd seen even a hint, I'd have crumbled. Major and I have had our eye on some property back in Georgia for a while. It's still on the market, so I think we'll put up a nice little house and dig in roots. We may even try our hand at farming.
Farming? Major laughed. A trendy chicken coop is not a farm, my dear.
We'll start there and see what happens. Glory winked in my direction. Your turn, Dot said. What's next for you?
For a little while, we thought you might stick around here.
She glanced at Bert. We weren't sure at first, but it seemed like you and Crawford...
What she's trying to say is it was nice to see some young love under the roof again, Bert said.
And he seems like a gentleman.
Knows how to treat a lady. That goes far in my book.
I'm sure she can rest easy knowing she has your approval, Dot said. Crawford put a lot of work into this house. He must be devastated that it's all going to be for naught. How is he handling everything?
My mind went back to something he'd said in the dining room the day the newspaper article came out. We'd finished breakfast and he was about to leave.
Most of the houses I work on are just jobs to me, he'd said. Occasionally I get asked to work on some great old house and it becomes more important, but when I finish the job, I move on to the next one without a hitch. This one was different from the start.
That's probably because you had your eye on the owner before you even saw the house, I said.
I got lucky. I heard she almost went with Earl and his overalls, he smiled.
The thing is, I've come to love the house, too.
When I first saw it, I loved that you weren't taking the easy road and unloading it as quickly as possible, which probably would have put it right into the hands of someone like Sammy. Yet here we are staring demolition in the face. He ran his hand through his hair, leaving it sticking up in tufts, and leaned toward me, his elbows on his knees. Regardless of the house, you come first. I can find another old house to fix up, but I don't want to lose you.
Dot looked at me, still waiting for an answer. Crawford was so kind and good. He'd probably never left anyone in the dust, as I had with Mags.
He wouldn't know how to do that.
I shook my head and answered the question she hadn't asked. I don't know what's going to happen.
In the last weeks, I spent as much time as I could soaking up the essence of the house and Mags. I walked down the long, curved driveway, watched the sunset from the dock, rocked on the porch, and sat in Mag's bedroom. I wanted to pack up the memories and take them with me, even if only in my mind. My last night in the house, I found myself in the garden at dusk. Cicadas serenaded me from their hidden places as I sat on Mag's bench, my fingers automatically finding the skeleton key on the underside. A light breeze blew in from the south. The sky darkened to a range of purples and pinks, and I let my tears fall without holding them back. I stayed in the garden long after darkness fell, covering everything like a warm, thick blanket. Some time later, the screen door creaked open.
"Sarah, honey?" Dot asked.
"You okay out there?"
I pulled myself up off the bench and took one last look around. In the dark, everything was a little out of focus. I saw myself as a child, scrambling through the garden, trying to snatch up as many strawberries as I could before Mags came around with her basket. Then as a teenager, sitting next to Mags on the bench, not understanding why she came out here every night in the dark to do nothing but think. Then me at 18, packing my suitcases and pulling away from the hideaway, leaving a smiling, waving Mags behind. It seemed everywhere I looked, every surface I touched, every sound I heard, reminded me of how I'd misunderstood, perhaps, the bravest woman I'd ever known. With my mind and heart full to overflowing, I turned and left the garden. The next morning, I stood in the driveway packing and repacking the trunk of my car. It all fit fine, but I kept rearranging items so I wouldn't have to look Crawford in the face. Everything William had made, and as many other pieces as we could haul, sat in a storage facility in Fairhope. The box containing Mag's most precious items sat up front on the passenger seat. Finally, Crawford put his hand on my arm. "I think it's fine," his voice cut through the quiet. Thunder rumbled in the distance, but the sun shone brightly. I exhaled and leaned my forehead on his chest. He wrapped his arms around my back, and his hands went to my hair, lifting the curls off my neck. I raised my face toward him, and he pressed his palms to my cheeks. "I'll miss you," he said. I nodded, not trusting my voice to speak. "I'm going to give you some time to get back in the swing of things at work. Pull Alan back in line, get your shop in order, whatever you need to do. I'm not going to bother you, but if you decide you want me there, I'll hop in the truck that minute. I mean it. I'll even bring popcorn if you want." "I don't need popcorn." I leaned my cheek on his chest. "Besides, who would take care of Charlie while you're gone?" "Good point." We were both quiet, then he cleared his throat. "I could say so many things right now, but I'm not going to. You know how I feel about you, and I think I know how you feel about me." "You think?" He sighed. "I can't help but think if you felt the way I do, you wouldn't be about to drive back to New Orleans." "He's right. What am I doing?" "But my shop, everything..." His shoulders tensed. I closed my eyes to keep the tears from falling. "I want my life to be here. I'm more me here than I've ever felt before. My life has changed, and it's because of you and Mags and this place. I wanted to say it, but I couldn't push the words out of my mouth." Crawford squeezed my shoulders, and I turned to open my car door. I didn't want to hurry away from him, but I needed the silence of my car to let my emotions go. I could feel another storm coming. It was lodged somewhere in my throat, and I preferred that it happen in private. I faced him for one last goodbye. His now familiar smell of cedar and fresh laundry, and something else vague but distinctly Crawford, filled my senses and muddied my thoughts. His lips were warm and soft, his faint stubble tickling my skin. I put my hand to his face and turned to climb in. He leaned down to the open window. "Sarah, please don't wait too long." Chapter 43, Sarah, September. Later that day, I opened the door to Bits and Pieces and inhaled the familiar scent of gardenia. I walked through the shop, running my fingers across chair backs, plump down pillows, and dustless tabletops. Alan had been hard at work. I walked behind the counter into our makeshift office. Alan was hunched over the laptop with his head in his hands. The glow from the screen made his face appear pale and sickly. "Hey," I said. Alan jumped, almost toppling his can of LaCroix on the table. "I didn't hear you come in. I've been trying to figure out all this QuickBooks stuff. Couldn't you just use a notebook and a calculator?" He nudged a chair out to me with the toe of his boot. I sank into it. "So, you're back," he said. "I'm back." I laid my head down on the table in front of me. He patted my shoulder, then reached into the mini-fridge and pulled out a beer. "It's only 2 o'clock. Is this what you've been doing since I've been gone?" "Calm down, boss. It's not for me." He opened the bottle and handed it to me. I hesitated, then took a long swallow. "William?" he asked. He's back in Still Pond, swimming in all the memories I dredged up for him. "He wants me to come visit him one day," I smiled. "He still makes furniture, you know." Alan nodded. "Maybe you can sell some here." I pushed back from the table, but Alan stopped me with a word. "Crawford?" "He's giving me some time to get settled in. He's waiting on a phone call telling him I'm ready for a visit." "That's a phone call that'll never happen," he said, partly under his breath. "What?" "You'll get back to work here, pick up some new clients, take off on salvaging trips, do what you do, and just not be able to find a free weekend for him to come." I shook my head. "No, I don't think that's what will happen at all. You and I both know how this will go. Alan cut off my babbling. The same thing happens every time you meet someone. I thought of Mitch and others before him. Mitch had lasted longer than most, but our mutual understanding got us both off the hook when our lives were too busy to connect. Am I talking to Alan, the therapist, or Alan, my friend? They're one and the same. I just know you better than you know yourself, so I'm obligated to warn you of what's to happen. We sat quietly until the bell on the door announced a customer and voices filled the room. Alan took me out onto the floor to show me some new mercury glass vases he'd brought in and a line of hand-painted ceramic dishes. They'd already sold out once, and he'd had to place a second order. Alan moved confidently through the shop, picking up a stray feather, brushing off a cushion with his hand. Alan, thank you for taking care of everything. I appreciate it. And you. Don't mention it. Anyway, I didn't expect you to come back, and I didn't want to be the reason it went under without the captain at the helm. Bits and Pieces is your baby, but you know how I feel about this place. It feels partly mine, too. You didn't think I'd come back? He shook his head. In all our years together, I always thought if you ever left New Orleans, it would be because you finally answered the call from that old house. Once you got settled there, I heard something different in your voice. You didn't sound like the girl who plans her day out to the last second and chafes when something interrupts the schedule. You sounded happy, and not in an I just scored a table for Mrs. Broussard kind of way. I don't chafe. My voice betrayed both my irritation and guilt. And I guess you don't know me as well as you think you do. I didn't stay, did I? No, you didn't. I sighed and stretched my arms over my head. You obviously have things under control here. I'm going back to the loft to unpack. I'll see you in the morning. I turned and headed for the door. Oh, no, you don't. For better or worse, you're back in New Orleans, and we're going to celebrate. You're not sitting home and pouting on your first night back. Let me make a few phone calls. I'll pick you up at 8. I didn't bother arguing. I knew I wouldn't win. At 8 on the dot, Alan picked me up on his motorcycle. He handed me a helmet and I climbed on, hitching my skirt up to my knees. I felt awkward back in my usual clothes. I thought I'd relish straightening my curls into submission and slipping my feet back into summery wedges, but my toes were cramped, and my work with the flat iron was no match for the thick humidity in the air. I missed the cutoffs, t-shirts, and air-dried hair that had become my staples in Sweet Bay. We sped through the quarters, tight streets, and back alleys until we reached the restaurant. Alan's friends waited outside for us, a colorful menagerie of laughter and hugs. On the way in the door, Alan pulled me to the side. Are you sure this is what you want? Sure, it'll be fun. I don't mean tonight. I'm talking about this, New Orleans, leaving Sweet Bay, coming back. I went to Sweet Bay for Mags. She's gone. The house is gone. This is where I belong. As I said the words, I thought of all I was giving up, but something told me I'd made my decision. I didn't let myself think of the implications. Whatever you say. Alan took my hand and led me inside. Dinner was as raucous as I'd expected it to be. After several rounds of after-dinner shots, most of which I politely declined, someone touched me on the shoulder. You're back. Mitch. Under the table, Alan nudged my knee. I didn't hear from you after you called about the house, he said. Did everything go okay? It was fine. I actually just got back today. I stayed a little longer than I expected. He nodded, unbothered by the fact that I had been gone for more than 4 months instead of a week as I had originally planned. The lively conversation at the table carried on without me, and no one looked our way, except for Alan, who kept one eye on us as he bantered with the group about a recent photo of Lady Gaga dressed as a drag queen. Mitch sat in the chair next to me, emptied when the previous occupant excused himself to go to the ladies' room. "You look good," he said. "Rested." Of all the things I looked, I knew rested was not one of them. Maybe it was what he thought I wanted to hear. He was the one who looked good. Sleek charcoal suit, white shirt unbuttoned at the throat, confident smile. It wasn't Crawford's torn khakis and wrinkled cotton, but it was nice. Just then, a wispy blonde with legs too long to be real sauntered over from the bar and put her hand on Mitch's shoulder. "Your drink is ready, baby." She gave me a once-over, then glided away to a small table in a dark corner. Mitch and I both watched her as she settled herself in her chair and gazed back at us with a look of amusement on her smooth face. "It's not what it looks like," he said. "It probably is, and it's okay. I'd love to call you, or better yet, what if I stop by later tonight?" "I don't think that's a good idea," I said. "Tomorrow, then. I'm free after 3. I can pick you up and take you somewhere quiet. I know you don't like places like this." I thought about it. I could slip back into my life like nothing had changed. Go back to the shop, back to fancy dates with Mitch every 2 weeks, back to my routine. It was tempting, if only because I knew I could bury myself in it. But everything had changed, and I'd be cheating everyone, Crawford, William, Mags, to pretend otherwise. I looked up at Mitch. His body was turned toward me, but his eyes were on the blonde. I cleared my throat, and he turned back to me. "What do you say?" he asked. "Go on," I nodded toward his date. "Enjoy yourself." He kissed me on the cheek and followed his date's path to the corner table, leaving a musky scent in his wake. Alan pushed my drink closer to me, but I nudged it away. "Sad to see him go?" he asked. "Not really." "So, small-town Alabama woodworkers are more your thing now, huh?" I smiled. "That covered both Crawford and William, sort of. Something like that." Alan dropped me off at my loft past midnight. I'd let him and his friends talk me into a dash to the revolving carousel bar at the Hotel Montlion after dinner. Thankfully, Alan whisked me away after one round, much to the dismay of the rest of the group. I dismounted at the curb in front of my loft and handed Alan the helmet. He was about to pull away when I stopped him. "Was there a part of you that hoped I wouldn't come back? You would have been the captain at the helm, after all." "No, I..." "Don't worry, I'm not mad," I said. "In fact, I totally get it. You can run bits and pieces with your eyes closed just like I can. It's your baby, too. I'd never wish for you to not come back. Understand that first. But if we're being honest, sure, I thought it'd be fun to have the run of the place. That is, if you even left it in my hands. You could just as easily have sold the shop and gotten a nice chunk of money out of it. I wouldn't have blamed you a bit." "I couldn't sell the shop. There's too much of me in it. And you." "Same thing with the hideaway," he said. "You could have sold that, but you didn't because there was too much of you and your family in it. You're funny that way. You hang on to things that mean something to you, but you have a hard time hanging on to the people who do the same. Other than me, of course. I know you could never let me go." I pinched his shoulder. "You're right. We're stuck at the hip. Lucky for both of us. But unlucky for Crawford." He revved his engine, but before he pulled away from the curb, he pulled his helmet back up. "You may think you have nothing left in Sweet Bay, but you're wrong. You do have something, regardless of the house. You have love, and you have family now. William, Dot, and Glory, and their old men. You can't tell me that's nothing." He snapped his helmet back into place and sped off. Chapter 44, Sarah, September. The next day began like so many others before it. I had my usual breakfast of yogurt and fruit, showered and dressed, and was out the door at 9:15. The last time I'd left my building on a regular work day, it was a crisp April morning. Now it was early September, cloudy and so muggy you could almost wring the air out like a sponge. I hopped into my car and zipped through the quarter and down canal toward Magazine. Along the way, other shop owners opened their doors, swept the detritus of the previous night from their sidewalks, and watered thirsty window boxes. I jiggled my key into the lock at bits and pieces, holding onto my purse and to-go cup of coffee. Alan roared into the driveway behind me. "Morning, boss." He tucked his helmet into its place under the seat. Inside, I flipped the lights on, powered up the computer, and switched on the Keurig in the back. When I checked the dish for pralines, I found squares of dark chocolate. The CD player held Michael Bublé rather than the usual Madeline Peru or Diana Krall. "Just small changes," Alan said, noticing my tension. "You can handle it." And I did. That day drifted into the next, and before I knew it, I'd been back a week. My skin prickled any time I thought of Crawford, but I tried to get through each day without thinking too much. I still felt restricted in my heels and smooth hair, but it fit my surroundings, and the shop was thriving. Nothing, and yet everything, had changed. The Saturday shoppers came early, reminding me why I loved retail in a tourist town. Whether they were from Louisiana or Minnesota, they all wanted to buy something embellished with New Orleans' famous fleur-de-lis. Thankfully, Alan had amped up our supply of pillows and knick-knacks featuring the symbol. I was blessedly busy all morning, my mind occupied with customer questions and client requests. I visited the site of Mrs. Broussard's new house to ensure the builders remembered to include the east-facing bay window in her walk-in closet dressing area at her special request, and I squeezed in a quick trip to an antique mall in Metairie. Alan and I passed each other in the back hallway once, both hurrying to meet a demand somewhere. "Glad you came back to this?" he asked with a smile. "I haven't sat down since I ate my breakfast this morning, and my feet are killing me, if that tells you anything." "Do you still love it?" I nodded. "I think I do. I just may have to take these heels off and go barefoot." "That's the sweet bay coming out in you," he continued down the hall to a waiting customer. Early afternoon business slowed enough for me to take a short break on the front porch. I sat in the swing as folks passed by on the sidewalk. I was fine until I saw the little girl. She was probably 4 or 5, with dark curls and still plump arms. Her daddy grabbed her and spun her around, her delighted squeals making everyone around them smile. When he brought her back to the ground, she ran straight into her mother's outstretched arms. All the sadness and longing I'd packed into the most remote pocket of my mind when I left Sweet Bay came flooding back. I thought of Mags, of William's old gnarled hands, and Crawford's sturdy, capable ones, of the hideaway and all that had taken place there. The force of my longing almost doubled me over. Alan chose that moment to stick his head out the front door. "You okay?" I managed a nod. He kept his eyes on me a moment longer before closing the door. Back on the sidewalk, the little family was gone. I stood and peered over the edge of the porch rail for a better view, but I didn't see any sign of them. I ran shaky hands over my hair and straightened my dress, then opened the door and walked back in. After a quick snack, consumed in stolen moments in the back office, my cell rang. I was busy with a customer, so Alan answered. A moment later, he mouthed something to me from across the room. I shook my head in confusion. He crossed the room and whispered, "It's Vernon Baines, the lawyer." I took the phone and left the customer in Alan's care. "Mr. Baines, this feels like a deja vu with you calling me here at work," I said as I stepped into our tiny courtyard and pulled the back door closed behind me. "Last time you had bad news." "Ah, Miss Jenkins, a common misconception. A lawyer on the phone doesn't always mean bad news. In this case, I have very good news for you. At least I think it's good." "I'm listening." "It appears Mr. Grosvenor has withdrawn his plan to take over the hideaway's property." "Excuse me?" "He called me early this morning and said he was going in a different direction." When I pressed, he said he bought another piece of property near Mobile Bay. He's scrapping the boardwalk idea and building his condos there instead. For better or worse, it appears Sweet Bay is destined to remain the secluded town it's always been.
I know, Mr. Baines continued. I was speechless, too. I forced my brain into gear. So if Sammy isn't taking it, does it just...
Everything goes back to normal. I can't say the mayor won't one day try to run with the plan again, but without Sammy's badgering him about it, and seeing as how most of the town of Sweet Bay was against it, hopefully he'll let the idea die. Alan stuck his head out the door. Everything okay? He walked into the courtyard and sat next to me.
What is it? He mouthed.
I shook my head.
I don't know what to make of Sammy's change of heart, Mr. Baines said. I'll let you know if I find out anything else.
Tell me, Alan said as soon as I put the phone down. Sammy isn't taking the house.
What happened?
I have no idea.
Alan sat back in the wrought iron rocker and crossed his arms.
You said you needed something to make Sammy go away. I guess that something happened.
A grin pushed at my cheeks. I couldn't wipe it away.
You're excited, Alan said.
I don't know what I am. I stood and took a deep breath, but I think I have to go.
Of course you do. Get out of here.
Wait, I sat back down. I can't do this. Mrs. Gerard is coming at 4, and I have a shipment.
Don't worry about it. I'll take care of everything, he said.
But what about...
Stop.
It's fine. You can go.
I don't even know what I'm going there to do.
Yes, you do. You've already started a life there. Now you're going to go back and pick up where you left off.
You make it sound so simple, I said.
Things aren't always as difficult as you make them out to be. Sometimes you just have to turn your brain off and dive in. This may be the last time Sweet Bay tries to pull you back.
I chewed on the end of a fingernail.
Crawford?
Only one way to find out.
I hugged Alan and went inside to grab my purse. On my way through the shop to the front door, I trailed my fingers on tabletops and chair backs. Pausing at the door, I turned to look through the room. Two women stood in the corner near an armoire, contemplating the big purchase. Alan joined them, and within seconds he had them laughing and moving toward the register. Bits and pieces would be just fine. On my way out of the city, I rolled my windows down as far as they'd go and dropped my heels on the floorboard next to me. I didn't know exactly what I'd find in Sweet Bay when I returned, but I wasn't going to let my last chance slip away without a fight. I called Dot from the car and told her I was on my way home.
Well, it's about time. I guess Vernon called you?
He called this afternoon. I was going to give you the news, but it sounds like you already know.
Oh, yes, she chuckled. A lot has happened since you've been gone.
Let's wait and talk when you get here, though. I need to make a phone call. She hung up before I could ask what was going on. A couple hours later, I pulled down the long driveway and shaded my eyes from one last sharp ray of light. Two people sat in rocking chairs on the porch, and one of them stood as I approached the house.
Crawford.
But it wasn't him. When my eyes adjusted to the shadowy light on the porch, I recognized William's slightly stooped figure. Dot sat in the chair next to him. I parked under the big oak and climbed out. Without stopping to grab my bag, I headed for the porch. William and Dot were both smiling.
What in the world is going on? I asked. How do you two...
It's been busy around here, Dot said. I looked at William.
I took care of Sammy, he said.
You what?
A long time ago, I bought a piece of property down at the mouth of Sweet Bay. I didn't think much about it until I decided that's where I wanted to build a house for me and Maggie one day. It doesn't have a name. We just called it the Cove.
I glanced at Dot. She winked.
I never built the house, but I kept the property all these years in hopes of, I don't even know. I just couldn't bear to part with it.
And you're giving it up now?
But how did you know?
It was Crawford,
Dot said. William nodded. He worked hard for this house after you left. He found me digging through old land records looking for anything that could fend off Sammy. He was the one who put it together that the cove could be the thing to save the house. Crawford did it? But why would Sammy want the cove? I asked. He visited me years ago and asked me about it. Turns out it's quite a coveted piece of property. I told him back then I'd never let it go, but now that Maggie... Well, once I met you, I realized I have no reason to hang on to it. All it took was a phone call. Sammy bought the property from me on the spot and signed the hideaway back to you. I can't believe you sold it, I said. I hope it's okay. His face clouded with concern. I could tell how much you loved this house, and I hated to see you lose it. Okay, I laughed. It's more than okay. I didn't have the right words, so I hugged him. And Dot, too. William and Crawford just couldn't give up on this old place, Dot said. Or you, it seems. I don't know about that. I haven't talked to Crawford since I left. Dot arched an eyebrow. And yet he's been here, doing all this work? Honey, he didn't do it for us. I got to know him a little this past week, William said. He builds things, you know. I nodded. I know. You have that in common. And you too. I pointed at William and Dot. Looks like you've sparked an unexpected friendship. Dot looked over at William. We had a lot to catch up on, that's for sure. Then she turned to me. Let's get you inside. I apologize in advance. It's a mess in there. I followed her through the front door where boxes and suitcases spilled in disarray all over the sparkling hardwoods. Despite the mess and the remaining old furniture, the house felt new. Even unfinished, the open floor plan, extra space, and fresh paint gave it life and new legs. Excitement fluttered again in my chest. We meant to be all packed up by now, but it's taking longer than we expected, Dot said. I put my hands on my hips and inhaled deep. Maybe you should just stay here then. Open-mouthed, Dot stared back at me. What? She asked, just as Major called down from the landing on the stairs. Thank the Lord. We're all old. Our kids can come visit us. I smiled and patted Dot on the arm, then headed for the kitchen to look for a celebratory bottle of wine. Go ahead and unpack your bags. You're not going anywhere. Chapter 45. Sarah. December. I stood in the hideaway's gleaming new kitchen, pouring a cup of coffee when Major stomped down the stairs. Sarah, where's my Gillette? And my toothbrush? I can't find anything in this blasted house. It's all in your new bathroom, the one attached to your room. You know you don't have to keep using the hall bath. That's why I built you and Glory your own. Major trudged back up the stairs, grumbling the whole way until Glory called out to him. Stop your whining, Major, or you'll be brushing your teeth on the dock. I took my coffee into the light-flooded dining room and sat at our new heart pine table. I ran my hand across the top, my fingers finding the indentations of the skeleton key at the edge. See, you'd have missed all this if you'd stayed in New Orleans, Bert said from across the table, working on his second apple scone. What would you do without Major's presence in your life? For one, I wouldn't have someone yelling at me about a toothbrush at 7 in the morning. I heard a tentative knock and looked up to see Mr. and Mrs. Melman. Breakfast is at 7, right? Mrs. Melman asked. Yes, please come in and make yourself at home, I said. Scones and coffee are just in the kitchen there, and muffins and fruit are on the table. Thank you. This place is wonderful, she said. Has the house been open long? Bert and I looked at each other. It's recently reopened, I said. Mrs. Melman touched her husband's elbow. We'll have to tell Maylene and George. They just love quaint places like this. As the Melmans shuffled into the kitchen, Bob Crow and his wife entered the dining room. Bob booked a weekend right after we opened for business. You've outdone yourself. He pulled a banana out of the basket on the table. I know I talked this place up in the newspaper article, but I still had doubts it would make it. You and me both, I said. How'd you get Sammy to back off anyway? It wasn't me. Someone offered him a better piece of property, and he took it. You sure got a lucky break. There's no chance anything Sammy could build would be half as classy as this. The crows followed the Melmans into the kitchen in search of steaming coffee and pastries. The air smelled of cinnamon and apples mixed with a tang of salty air from the open windows. The sky was bright, the sun sparkled, and my heart was full. My new hideaway, my new life. It wasn't lost on me that if it weren't for Mags drawing me back to Sweet Bay, I wouldn't have had any of this. I'd still be churning away in New Orleans, thinking I'd found all I was to do with my life. I thought I was done with the hideaway forever, but family was the magnetic pull that drew me back. I may have given up on Mags a long time ago, but in her own unorthodox way, she was the one who saved me in the end. The phone in the hall rang, and I jumped up to get it. "The hideaway, this is Sarah." I loved the words as they left my mouth. "Hey, babe," Crawford said. "Hey, yourself. Why didn't you call my cell?" "I know you love answering the house phone." I smiled, even though he couldn't see me. "You're out early this morning," I said. The background noise told me he was in his truck with the windows down. "I'm on my way to the McCafferty's house in Lillian to meet the floor guy. You'd love this place. It's a rambling old creole full of antiques. I mean, antique antiques." "What are they doing to the house?" "Adding on. Again. They need room for the grandkids. Although I don't know how kids and all these antiques will mix. How did the night go?" "Was Major on his best behavior?" "I didn't hear a peep out of him until he got feisty this morning about his toothbrush. But he's fine. It's all perfect, actually." It had been a few weeks since the last construction worker left, but the newness had yet to wear off for me. "I can't wait to see you," he said. "I have a few more stops to make, then I'll head your way. Need anything? Just you." At 10, after giving the Melmans a map of the eastern shore of Mobile Bay and suggesting a few places they could grab lunch, I went next door. It was a beautiful thing, my business being 40 feet from my home. Sometimes I missed the clattering streetcars and morning rush of traffic in the quarter, but you couldn't beat walking next door with your coffee mug to flip the open sign around and begin the day. In the 3 months I'd been back in Sweet Bay, for the second time, renovations on the hideaway had wrapped up, and Crawford and his team built a small cottage on the empty lot next door. We were fortunate to have a long stretch of good weather in the early fall, and the builders made quick work of the cottage. It now housed my new shop, Lost and Found. Alan was the one who'd convinced me I could do it. "You started the first shop from scratch. Why can't you do it again?" "Alabama surely has just as many estate sales and old barns to salvage as Louisiana does. They'll eat your stuff up, just like they do here." Crawford was on Alan's side, of course. They met when Crawford and I drove to New Orleans to pack up my loft and bring a few things back home from the shop. Alan insisted on taking us out to dinner. I picked a sidewalk cafe near Jackson Square, a place I thought would be just noisy enough to distract us from the fact that Crawford and Alan would have nothing to talk about. But I was wrong. I could hardly get a word in between them bantering back and forth, first about farming and motorcycles, then about me. "You're the lucky one who gets all of Sarah's pent-up romantic yearnings," Alan said to Crawford, nudging me with his shoulder. "That makes me sound like I've been locked up in a tower somewhere." "You basically have," he said, then turned to Crawford. "No one has been able to break down that wall she built around herself." "You did the hard work," Crawford said. "All your advice at least convinced her to give me a shot." "Do I even need to be here? I can scoot out if you two want to keep talking about me and my wall." Crawford smiled at me. A candle flickered on the table between us, right next to a red glass vase holding a plastic rose. His knee touched mine under the table, The truth was, I'd had to convince him to give me a shot when I got back to Sweet Bay. I drove to his house after I told Dot and the others they didn't have to move out. He didn't believe I was there to stay. "I can't do this twice," he said. "How do I know you're not going to skip town again?" "I'm not going anywhere. This is where I need to be, where I want to be. Everything has changed." Crawford leaned against his kitchen counter, hands in his pockets, and smiled. But it wasn't his usual smile. "Of course it has. You have the house back." "Yes, I have the house, but it's more than that. I'm sorry for not calling, for not explaining myself to you. Once I got back to New Orleans, it didn't take long to realize I'd made a huge mistake." I stepped closer to him and put my hand to his face. "There's nowhere else I want to be, and no one else I want to be with." He covered my hand with his own, but still didn't speak. Finally, he gave me a real smile. "You're back?" "I'm back for good." Despite being a week into December, it was a warm day. Sunlight flooded through the bank of the windows facing the bay. Not long after I propped open the front door, a gaggle of ladies entered the shop, all fleshy arms and laughter. "You'll have to forgive us if we're too loud, dear," one of them said. "We're just excited to be here on a girls' weekend. Our husbands are out hunting, and we have a lot of shopping to do." "You've come to the right place. I have a little bit of everything, so make yourselves at home. Let me know if you have questions." They were still puttering and gossiping when Crawford walked in. It may sound crazy, but I could have sworn the sun blazed brighter and the breeze turned warmer when he entered. Or at least that's how it felt to me. He walked through the room, stopping to chat with the ladies and make them blush with nothing but his charm and easy smile. It was hard to believe I'd even considered leaving him and everything else for my overloaded life in New Orleans. "This is perfect," one of the women touched a buffet table in the back of the shop. "I'm looking for something just like this to go in my dining room. I love the rustic look. Where did it come from?" "A woodworker up in Still Pond made it," I said. "He's been making pieces like this for most of his life. He can't handle the workload he used to, so he only makes a limited number of pieces now. I have two tables in here and another handful next door that are also for sale. He does custom orders here and there, if you ask nicely." She chuckled and smoothed her hand down the length of the table. "You won't find another table filled with as much love as this one. Look here, see this key engraved into the wood? He cuts the key into every piece he makes. He started doing it 50 years ago when he fell in love with a girl named Maggie. He said she held the key to his heart." "Well, you don't hear that every day," the woman said. "What happened to them? Tell me they married and lived a happy life together." "They didn't marry," I said, "but they should have. I'm pretty sure she loved him until she died earlier this year, and he still very much loves her." "Sounds like you know this woodworker well." From across the room, Crawford caught my eye and winked. I nodded. "I do. He's my grandfather." That night, long after the last customers found their way out of the shop, most with shopping bags rustling around their knees, Crawford and I relaxed in the rocking chairs on the back porch of the hideaway. The Crows were getting ready for a dinner I'd booked for them at the Grand Hotel in Point Clear, and the Melmans were at the Outrigger. Another group of guests wasn't arriving until the next afternoon, so I had the evening off. I sipped my wine and settled farther into my chair. My legs rested on a blanket in Crawford's lap, and he gently squeezed my bare feet. A scuffle in the house behind us made us both look up to the open doorway. Bert stood with one hand on the doorframe, the other caught in Dot's firm grasp. "Bert, give them some privacy," she scolded. Then turned to me. "I'm sorry. I told him you two wouldn't be interested in his silly games, but he's being very pig-headed." Bert shook his hand free from Dot's and walked out on the porch. "I picked up this new game at Grimerson's today. George said it's popular with the young people. It's Pictionary, Dot said, exasperated. Crawford grinned. What do you say? He whispered. I can draw a mean crawfish, I whispered back. Let's do it, he said. Here's to another night in paradise. Chapter 46, Mags. March, 9 months earlier. I often went back to the cove. I went on days when I couldn't bear the loneliness of missing William. Or maybe I just pined for that short, sweet time in my life when he would hold me, touch me, make me feel as alive as a power line, shooting sparks and electricity out into the universe. I'd sit along the edge of the water and imagine what it would have been like if things had turned out differently. If Robert hadn't had that first episode and landed himself in the hospital, or if I'd never cashed that check, leading Daddy to the hideaway, William and I might have still been together. We would have spent every evening out on our porch overlooking the water, dumbstruck at our love and how lucky we were to have found each other. Or maybe that's not true at all. Maybe we would have fizzled as quickly as we began, a bright burst of fire at the beginning and another dimmer burst at the end, like a firework that never quite made it off the ground. We could have hurt each other a thousand ways, both of us eventually needing more and offering less than we had to give. I would have always wondered if he stayed with me out of a sense of duty because of Jenny, while he'd worry that I'd only stayed with him to defy Robert and my parents. I could dream all day long, but at its core, the truth of my life is that I am a lucky woman. I've known real love and true beauty, two things not given to every person. Without Robert, I never would have found my way to the hideaway or William. And without William, I wouldn't have known the delight of both Jenny and Sarah. While I'm thankful for both of these men in my life, I'm more thankful for the woman they showed me I could be on my own, not to mention the people they brought into my life. The hideaway was always full of friends and lovers, mothers and daughters, secret keepers and secret spillers, straight talkers and soft shoulders. We had hurt and we had joy, but I wouldn't have had it any other way. Things could have turned out better or worse, but I don't dwell on any of that. I have a tarnished old house to live in, a garden to keep my hands dirty, and sunsets to watch. Sitting here on my old cedar bench, my toes dug deep in the earth, herons swooping low over the water, and the sun an orange ball of fire slipping below the horizon, I figure I've had it just about as good as it gets.
You've been listening to the audio production of The Hideaway, text copyright 2017 by Lauren K. Denton, production copyright 2017 by Thomas Nelson. No portion of this recording may be reproduced without the prior written consent of the publisher. For more information on other fine books and audio products from Thomas Nelson, please visit your favorite retailer or visit us online at thomasnelson.com. The Hideaway was produced by Beanstalk Creative and recorded on location at Red Records in Franklin, Tennessee.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.